Part 2. Anapoli. Chapter 20. The Marais, Paris. The quarter of Paris known as the Marais lies on the right bank of the Seine and spreads across portions of the 3rd and 4th arrondissements. Once a marshland, it had been a fashionable address during the monarchy, a working-class slum after the revolution, and in the 20th century, the city's most vibrant Jewish neighborhood. Scene of a nightmarish Nazi roundup during the Second World War, it had fallen into a state of ruin by the 1960s when the government launched a concerted effort to bring it back to life. Now among the most fashionable districts in Paris, the Marais was filled with exclusive shops, art museums, and trendy restaurants. It was in one such restaurant, on Rue des Archives, that Uzi Leboeuf waited late the following afternoon. He wore a roll-neck sweater that left the unflattering impression his head was bolted directly onto his thick shoulders. He scarcely lifted his eyes as Gabriel and Olga sat down. They had arrived in Paris shortly after 10 the previous evening, and checked into a dreary little transit hotel across the street from the Gare du Nord. The journey had been uneventful. There had been no more attacks by Russian assassins, and Olga's cat had behaved as well as could be expected during the train ride from Oxford to Paddington Station. Due to the Eurostar's ban on pets, Gabriel had had no choice but to find lodging for the cat in London. He had taken it to an art gallery in St. James, owned by a man named Julian Isherwood. Over the years, Isherwood had suffered many indignities because of his secret association with the office, but to have a stranger's cat thrust upon him without warning was, he said, the final insult. His mood, however, changed dramatically upon seeing Olga for the first time. But then Gabriel had known it would. Julian Isherwood had a weakness for three things: Italian paintings, French wine, and beautiful women, especially Russian women. And, like Uzi Leboeuf, he was easily appeased.
"I don't know why we had to come to this place," Leboeuf said now. "You know how much I love the potted chicken at Joe Goldenberg."
"It's closed, Uzi, haven't you heard?"
"I know, but I still can't quite believe it. What's the Marais without Joe Goldenberg?"
For more than half a century, the kosher delicatessen had occupied a prominent corner at 7 Rue des Rossiers. Jews from around the world had crowded into the restaurant's worn red banquettes and gorged themselves on caviar, chopped liver, brisket, and potato latkes. So had French film stars, government ministers, and famous writers and journalists. But the prominence of Joe Goldenberg made it an inviting target for extremists and terrorists, and in August 1982, 6 patrons were killed in a grenade and machine gun attack carried out by the Palestinian terrorist group Abu Nidal. In the end, though, it was not terrorism that brought down the Paris landmark, but soaring rents and repeated citations for poor sanitary conditions.
"You're lucky that chicken didn't kill you, Uzi. God knows how long it had been lying around before they tossed it in a bowl and served it to you."
"It was excellent, and so was the borscht.
You loved the borscht at Joe Goldenberg."
"I hate borscht. I've always hated borscht."
"Then why did you order it?"
"You ordered it for me, and then you ate it for me, too."
"I don't remember it that way."
"Whatever you say, Uzi." They had been speaking to one another in rapid French. Leboeuf turned to Olga and in English asked,
"Wouldn't you have enjoyed a good bowl of borscht, Miss Sukova?"
"I'm Russian. Why on earth would I come to Paris and order borscht?"
Leboeuf looked at Gabriel again.
"Is she always so friendly?"
he asked in Hebrew. "Russians have a somewhat dark sense of humor."
"I'll say."
Leboeuf glanced out the window into the narrow street.
"This place has changed since I left Paris. I used to come here whenever I had a few hours to kill. It was like a little slice of Tel Aviv right in the center of Paris. Now,"
he shook his head slowly,
"it's just another place to buy a handbag or expensive jewelry. You can't even get good falafel here anymore."
"That's exactly the way the mayor wants it. Neat and tidy, with lots of chic stores paying big rents and big tax bills. They even tried to put in the McDonald's a few months back, but the neighborhood rose up in rebellion. Poor Joe Goldenberg couldn't make a go of it anymore. At the end, his rent was 300,000 euros a year.
No wonder the kitchen was a mess."
Leboeuf looked down at his menu. When he spoke again, his tone was decidedly less cordial.
"Let me see if I understand this correctly. I come to Italy and order you to return to Israel because we believe your life may be in danger. You tell me that you need 3 days to finish a painting, and I foolishly agree. Then, within 24 hours, I learn that you slipped away from the bodyguards and traveled to London to investigate the disappearance of one Grigory Volganov, missing Russian defector. And this morning, I receive a message saying you've arrived in Paris, accompanied by Russian defector number 2, Olga Sukova. Have I left anything out?
We had to leave Olga's cast behind at Julian's gallery. We need to send someone from London Station to collect it. Otherwise, Julian's liable to let it loose in Green Park.
Gabriel removed Grigory's letter from his coat pocket and dealt it onto the table. Navot read it silently, his face an inscrutable mask, then looked up again.
I want to know everything you did while you were in England, Gabriel. No shortcuts, deletions, edits, or abridgments, do you understand me?
Gabriel gave Navot a complete account, beginning with his first meeting with Graham Seymour, and ending with the assassination attempt on Olga's doorstep.
They disabled the lock? Navot asked.
It was a nice touch.
It's a shame the shooter didn't realize you were unarmed. He could have simply climbed out of the car and killed you.
You don't really mean that, Uzi?
No, but it makes me feel better to say it. Rather sloppy for a Russian hit team, don't you think?
It's not so easy to kill someone from a moving vehicle.
Unless you're Gabriel Alon. When we set our sights on someone, he dies. The Russians are usually like that, too. They're fanatics when it comes to planning and preparation.
Gabriel nodded in agreement.
So why send a couple of amateurs to Oxford?
Because they assumed it would be easy. They probably thought the second string could handle it.
You're assuming Olga was the target and not you?
That's correct.
What makes you so sure?
I'd only been in the country 3 days. Even me would be hard-pressed to organize a hit that quickly.
So why didn't they call it off when they saw she wasn't alone?
It's possible they simply mistook me for Olga's boyfriend or one of her students.
Not someone who knows to hit the deck when a lock suddenly stops working.
A waiter approached the table. Navot sent him away with a subtle gesture of his hand.
It might have been wiser if you'd shared some of these observations with Graham Seymour. He allowed you to conduct your own review of Grigory's disappearance, and how did you repay him? By sneaking out of the country with another one of his defectors.
Navot, a humorless smile.
Graham and I could form our own little club. Men who have placed their trust in you, only to be burned.
Navot looked at Olga, and switched from Hebrew to English.
Your neighbors didn't notice the bullet holes in the broken front door until about 8 o'clock. When they couldn't find you, they called the Thames Valley Police.
I'm afraid I know what happened next, she said, because my address has a special security flag on it. The dispatch officer immediately contacted the chief constable.
And guess what the chief constable did?
I suspect he called the Home Office in London. And did the Home Office contact Graham Seymour?
Navot's gaze shifted from Olga to Gabriel.
And what do you think Graham Seymour did?
He called our London station chief,
who'd been quietly scouring the city for you for the past 3 days.
Navot added.
And when Graham got the station chief on the telephone, he read him the Riot Act. Congratulations, Gabriel. You've managed to bring relations between the British and the office to a new low. They want a full explanation of what happened in Oxford last night. And they'd also like their defector back. Graham Seymour is expecting us in London tomorrow morning, bright and early.
Us?
You, me, and Olga.
Then, almost as an afterthought, Navot added,
and the old man, too.
How did Shamron manage to get himself involved in this?
The same way he always does. Shamron abhors a vacuum. He sees an empty space, and he fills it.
Tell him to stay in Tiberias. Tell him we can handle it.
Please, Gabriel, as far as Shamron is concerned, we're still a couple of kids trying to learn how to ride a bicycle, and he can't quite bring himself to let go of the seat. Besides, it's too late. He's already here.
Where is he?
A safe flat up in Montmartre. Olga and I will stay here and get better acquainted. Shamron would like a word with you, in private.
About what?
He didn't tell me. After all, I'm only the chief of special ops.
Nebo looked down at his menu and frowned.
No potted chicken. You know how much I love the potted chicken at Joe Goldenberg. The only thing better than the potted chicken was the borscht.
Chapter 21 Montmartre, Paris. The apartment house stood in the eastern fringes of Montmartre, next to the cemetery. It had a tidy interior courtyard and an elegant staircase covered by a well-worn runner. The flat was on the third floor. From the window of the comfortably furnished sitting room, it might have been possible to see the white dome of Sacré-Cœur, had Chamron not been blocking the view. Hearing the sound of the door, he turned around slowly and stared at Gabriel for a long moment, as if debating whether to have him shot or thrown to the wild dogs. He was wearing a gray pinstripe suit and a costly silk necktie the color of polished silver. It made him look like an aging Middle European businessman who made money in shady ways and never lost at baccarat.
"We missed you at lunch, Harry."
"I don't eat lunch."
"Not even when you're in Paris."
"I love Paris, especially in winter."
He fished a cigarette case from the breast pocket of his jacket and thumbed open the lid.
"I thought you'd finally given up smoking."
"And I thought you were in Italy finishing a painting."
Chamron removed a cigarette, tapped the end three times on the lid, and slipped it between his lips.
"And you wonder why I won't retire."
His lighter flared. It was not the battered old Zippo he carried at home, but a sleek silver device that, at Chamron's command, produced a blue finger of flame. The cigarette, however, was his usual brand, unfiltered and Turkish. It emitted an acrid odor that was as unique to Chamron as his trademark walk and his unyielding will to crush anyone foolish enough to oppose him. To describe the influence of Ari Chamron on the defense and security of the State of Israel was tantamount to explaining the role played by water in the formation and maintenance of life on Earth. In many respects, Ari Chamron was the State of Israel. He had fought in the war that led to Israel's reconstitution, and had spent the subsequent 60 years protecting the country from a host of enemies bent on its destruction. His star had burned brightest in times of war and crisis. He was named director of the office for the first time not long after the disaster of the 1973 Yom Kippur War, and served longer than any chief before or after him. When a series of public scandals dragged the reputation of the office down to the lowest point in its history, he was called out of retirement, and with Gabriel's help, restored the office to its former glory. His second retirement, like his first, was involuntary. In some quarters, it was likened to the destruction of the Second Temple. Chamron's role now was that of an éminence grise. Though he no longer had a formal position or title, he remained the hidden hand that guided Israel's security policies. It was not unusual to enter his home at midnight and find several men crowded around the kitchen table in their shirt sleeves, shouting at one another through a dense cloud of cigarette smoke. And poor Gila, his long-suffering wife, sitting in the next room with her needlepoint and her Mozart, waiting for the boys to leave so that she could see to the dishes.
"You've managed to create quite a row on the other side of the English Channel, my son. But then, that's become your specialty."
Chamron exhaled a stream of smoke toward the ceiling, where it swirled in the half-light like gathering storm clouds.
"Your friend Graham Seymour is apparently fighting for his job. Mazel tov, Gabriel. Not bad for 3 days' work."
"Graham will survive. He always does."
"At what cost?"
Chamron asked of no one but himself.
"Downing Street and the top ranks of MI5 and MI6 are in an uproar over your actions. They are making unpleasant noises about suspending cooperation with us on a broad range of sensitive issues. We need them right now, Gabriel, and so do you."
"Why me?"
"Perhaps it's escaped your notice, but the mullahs in Tehran are about to complete their nuclear weapon. Our new Prime Minister and I share a similar philosophy. We don't believe in sitting around while others plot our destruction. And when people talk about wiping us off the face of the earth, we choose to take them at their word. We both lost our families in the first Holocaust, and we're not going to lose our country to a second, at least not without a fight."
Chamron removed his eyeglasses and inspected the lenses for impurity.
"If we are forced to attack Iran, we can expect a ferocious response from their proxy army in Lebanon, Hezbollah. You should know that the delegation from Hezbollah made a secret trip to Moscow recently to do a bit of shopping, and they weren't looking for nesting dolls and fur hats. They went to see your old friend, Ivan Karkov. Word is, Yvonne sold them 3,000 Cornet vehicle-mounted anti-tank weapons, along with several thousand RPG-32s. Apparently, he also gave them a nice discount, since he knew they'd be using the weapons against us.
You're sure it was Yvonne?
We heard his name mentioned in several intercepts.
Shamron put on his eyeglasses again and scrutinized Gabriel for a moment.
With adversaries like Iran, Hezbollah, and Ivan Kharkov, we need friends wherever we can find them, Gabriel. That's why we need good relations with the British.
Shamron paused.
And it's why I need you to end your honeymoon without end and come home.
Gabriel could see where this was headed. He decided not to make Shamron's task any easier by posing a leading question. Shamron, visibly annoyed by the calculated silence, stabbed out his cigarette in an ashtray on the coffee table.
Our new Prime Minister has been an admirer of yours for many years. The same cannot be said of his feelings toward the current director of the office. He and Amos served briefly together in Amman, Israel's military intelligence service. Their hatred was mutual and persists to this day. Amos will not survive long. Last week over a private dinner, the Prime Minister asked me who I wanted to be the next chief of the office. I gave him your name, of course.
I've made it abundantly clear I'm not interested in the job.
I've heard this speech before. It's tiresome. More to the point, it does not reflect current realities. The state of Israel is facing a threat unlike any in its history. If you have noticed, we're not very popular right now. And the Iranian threat means even greater instability and potential violence across the region. What do you intend to do, Gabriel? Sit on your farm in Italy and restore paintings for the Pope?
Yes.
That's not realistic.
Perhaps not to you, Ari, but it's what I intend to do. I've given my life to the office. I've lost my son. I've lost one wife. I've shed the blood of other men and my own blood. I'm finished. Tell the Prime Minister to choose someone else.
He needs you. The country needs you.
You're being a bit hyperbolic, don't you think?
No. Just honest. The country has lost faith in its political leaders. Our society is beginning to fray. The people need someone they can believe in, someone they can trust, someone beyond reproach.
I was an assassin. I'm hardly beyond reproach.
You were a soldier on the secret battlefield. You gave justice to those who could not seek it themselves.
And I lost everything in the process. I almost lost myself.
But your life has been restored, just like one of your paintings. You have Chiara. Who knows, perhaps soon you'll have another child.
Is there something I should know, Ari? Shamron's lighter flared again. His next words were spoken not to Gabriel, but the floodlit dome of Sacré-Cœur.
Come home, Gabriel. Take control of the office. It is what you were born to do. Your future was determined when your mother named you Gabriel.
That was the same thing you said when you recruited me for Operation Wrath of God.
Was it?
Shamron gave a faint smile of remembrance.
No wonder you said yes to me then.
Shamron had been hinting at a scenario like this for years, but never before had he stated it so unequivocally. Gabriel, were he foolish enough to accept the offer, knew only too well how he would spend the rest of his life. Indeed, he had to look no further than the man standing before him. Running the office had ruined Shamron's health and wreaked havoc with his family. The country regarded him as a national treasure, but as far as his children were concerned, Shamron was the father who had never been there. The father who had missed birthdays and anniversaries. The father who traveled in armored cars surrounded by men with guns. It was not the life Gabriel wanted, nor did he intend to inflict it on his loved ones. To say those words to Shamron now was not an option. Better to hold out a glimmer of hope and use the situation to his advantage. Shamron would understand that. It was exactly the way he would have played it if the roles were reversed. How long before I would have to take control?
Does that mean you'll take the job?
No. It means I'll consider the offer on two conditions.
I don't like ultimatums. The PLO learned that lesson the hard way.
Do you want to hear my terms?
If you insist.
Number one, I get to finish my painting. Chevron closed his eyes and nodded.
And the second?
I'm going to get Grigory Bulganov out of Russia before Ivan kills him.
I was afraid you were going to say that.
Chevron took a final pull at his cigarette and ground it out slowly in the ashtray.
See if there's some coffee in this place. You know I'm incapable of discussing an operation without coffee.
Chapter 22. Montmartre, Paris. Gabriel spooned coffee into the French press and briefed Chamron while waiting for the water to boil. Chamron sat motionless at the small table in his shirt sleeves, his liver-spotted hands bunched thoughtfully beneath his chin. He moved for the first time to read the letter Grigory had left with Olga Sukova in Oxford, then a moment later to accept his first cup of coffee. He was pouring sugar into it when he announced his verdict.
It's clear Ivan is planning to hunt down and kill everyone who was involved in the operation against him. First he went after Grigory, then Olga, but the person he really wants is you.
So what do you want me to do? Spend the rest of my life hiding?
Gabriel shook his head. To quote the great Ari Chamron, I don't believe in sitting around while others plot my destruction. It seems to me we have a choice. We can live in fear, or we can fight back.
And how do you suggest we do that?
By treating Ivan and his operators as though they are terrorists. By putting them out of business before they can go after anyone else. And if we're lucky, we might be able to get Grigory back.
Where do you plan to start?
Gabriel unzipped the side compartment of his overnight bag and withdrew an enlarged photograph of a Mercedes sedan with two people in the back seat. Chamron slipped on a pair of battered half-moon reading glasses and examined the image. Then Gabriel placed another photograph before him, the photo that had been attached to the letter in Oxford. Grigory and Irina in happier times.
I suppose we know how they got him into the car so quietly,
Chamron said.
Did you share this with your British friends?
It might have slipped my mind while I was fleeing the country one step ahead of a Russian hit squad.
Accompanied by Graham Seymour's defector.
Chamron spent a moment scrutinizing the photograph.
Tell me what you have in mind, my son.
I made a promise to Grigory the night he saved my life. I intend to keep that promise.
Grigory Bulganov has a British passport. That makes him a British problem.
Graham Seymour made one thing abundantly clear to me in London, Ari. As far as the British are concerned, Grigory is my defector, not theirs. And if I don't try to get him back, no one will.
Chamron tapped the photograph.
And you think she can help you?
She saw their faces, heard their voices. If we can get to her, she can help us.
And what if she's not willing to help you? What if she willingly took part in the operation?
I suppose anything is possible.
But?
I doubt it very seriously. Based on what Grigory told me, Irina hated the FSB and everything it stood for. It was one of the reasons their marriage came apart.
Were there any other reasons?
She was ashamed of Grigory for taking money from Ivan Karkov. She called it blood money. She wouldn't touch it.
Perhaps Irina had a change of heart. Russians can be very persuasive, Gabriel. And if there's one thing I've learned in this life, it's that everyone has a price.
You might be right, Ari, but we won't know for sure until we ask her.
A conversation, is that what you're suggesting?
Something like that.
What makes you think they haven't killed her?
I called her office this morning. She answered the phone.
Chamron drank some of his coffee and pondered the implications of Gabriel's statement.
Let me make one thing clear from the outset. Under no circumstances are you or anyone else from the original operation against Ivan going back to Moscow, ever.
I have no intention of going back.
So how are you going to arrange a meeting with her?
Gabriel gave the rough outlines of his plan. Chamron twirled his lighter between his fingertips while he listened. Two turns to the right, two turns to the left.
It has one flaw. You're assuming she'll cooperate.
I'm assuming nothing.
She'll have to be handled carefully until you're certain of her true loyalties.
And that's about as well.
I suppose you'd like to use your old team. It saves time having to get acquainted. How much money is this going to cost me?
Gabriel added coffee to Chamron's cup and smiled. The old man had worked for the office during a time when it counted every shekel, and he still acted as if operational funds came directly from his own pocket. 100,000 should cover it.
100,000?
I was going to ask for 2.
I'll transfer the funds into your account in Zurich tomorrow morning. As soon as you've established the base of operations, I'll dispatch the team.
What are you going to tell Amos?
As little as possible.
And the British?
Leave that to me. I'll brief them about your plans and make it clear we'll share whatever information you discover.
Cameron paused.
You will share nicely, won't you, Gabriel?
Absolutely.
To be honest, I'm sure they'll be relieved we're handling it. The last thing Downing Street wants is another confrontation with the Russians, not with the British economy on life support. They're more interested in making sure that Russian money continues to flow into the banks of London.
At least one problem.
Just one?
Olga.
I'll return her to the British tomorrow and fall on my sword on your behalf. I've brought along a little present for them. Some chatter we've been picking up in Lebanon about the possible terror plot in London.
You can tell them about the chatter in Lebanon, Ari. But I'm afraid Olga isn't going back to Britain anytime soon.
You can't leave her here in Paris.
I don't intend to. I'm taking her with me. She's really rather good, you know.
Something tells me my stay in London isn't going to be a pleasant one.
Chamron sipped his coffee.
You'd better have a word with Uzi. Whatever you do, don't mention our conversation about your taking control of the office. He's not going to be thrilled about the prospect of working for you.
I never said I would take the job, Ari. I said I would consider it.
I urged you the first time, but I know you wouldn't be leading me on, not over something as important as this.
I need you to do me one other favor while we're in London.
What's that?
I have to leave Olga's cat with Julian Isherwood.
Chamron began turning his lighter again.
I hate cats. And the only thing I hate worse than cats is being lied to.
Chapter 23. Lake Como, Italy. Lake Como lies in the northeastern corner of the region of Lombardy, just a few miles from the Swiss border. Shaped like an inverted Y, it is surrounded by soaring alpine peaks and dotted with picturesque towns and villages. One of Europe's deepest lakes, it is also, sadly, among its most polluted. In fact, a recent study by an Italian environmental group found that bacteria levels had reached 68 times the limit for safe human bathing. The culprits were antiquated lakeside sewage systems, runoff from nearby farms and vineyards, and a reduction in rainfall and mountain snowpack attributed, rightly or wrongly, to global warming. Under pressure from the local tourism industry, the government had promised dramatic action to prevent the lake from slipping past the point of no return. Most Italians weren't holding their breath. Their government was rather like a charming rogue, good at making promises, not so good at keeping them. To stand on the terraces of Villa Teresa, however, was to forget that the magnificent waters of Lake Como had been spoiled in any way. Indeed, at certain times of the day, and under proper light and weather conditions, one could imagine there was no such thing as global warming, no wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, no worldwide financial crisis, and no possible threat looming anywhere over the ring of protective mountains. Built by a wealthy Milanese trader in the 18th century, the villa stood on its own small peninsula. It was 3 floors in height, tawny orange in color, and accessible only by boat. A fact that Herr Heinrich Kiva, chief operating officer of Matrix Technologies of Zug, Switzerland, found highly appealing. Herr Kiva, it seemed, was looking for a private retreat where his employees could complete work on a major project free from distractions and in a setting that would inspire greatness. After a brief tour, he declared Villa Teresa perfection itself. The contracts were signed over coffee in the town of Laglio, home of an American movie star whose highly publicized presence in Como was, in the opinion of many long-time habitués, the worst thing to happen to the lake since the invention of the gasoline-powered engine. Herr Kiva paid the entire lease with a certified check drawn on his bank in Zurich. He then informed the rental agent he required complete privacy, meaning no maid service, no cooks, and no follow-up calls from the agency. If there were any problems, he explained, the agent was the first to know. Herr Kiewer took up residence in the villa that same afternoon, along with two women. One was a striking brunette with a face like a Russian icon. The other, an attractive Italian accompanied by a pair of matching bodyguards. Unbeknownst to the rental agency, Herr Kiewer and the bodyguards had a brief but heated argument before conducting a meticulous sweep of the property for hidden microphones or other eavesdropping equipment. Satisfied the estate was secure, they settled into their rooms and awaited the arrival of the remaining guests. There were six in all, four men and two women, and they came not from Zurich, but from an anonymous-looking office block on King Saul Boulevard in Tel Aviv. They had traveled to Europe separately under false names and with false passports in their pockets. Three landed in Rome and made the drive north. Three landed in Zurich and drove south. By some miracle, they arrived at the villa's private landing just 5 minutes apart. Herr Kiewer, who was waiting to greet them, declared it a good omen. The six men and women withheld judgment. They had sailed under Herr Kiewer's star before, and knew calm waters often gave way to storm-tossed seas with little or no warning. So, too, did the newest addition to this illustrious band of operatives, Olga Sukova. They knew her by name and reputation, of course, but none had ever actually met the famed Russian journalist. Gabriel saw to the introductions with a studied evasiveness only a veteran of the secret world could summon. He provided Olga with first names, but made no mention of current positions or past professional exploits. As far as Gabriel was concerned, the six individuals were blank slates, tools that had been lent to him by a higher power. They approached her in pairs and carefully shook her hand. The women, Ramona and Dina, came first. Ramona was in her mid-30s and had shoulder-length hair the color of Jerusalem limestone. A major in the IDF, she had worked for several years as an analyst for Amman before transferring to the office, where she was now part of a special Iran task force. Dina, petite and dark-haired, was an office terrorism specialist who had personally experienced its horrors. In October 1994, she was standing in Tel Aviv's Dizengoff Square when a Hamas terrorist detonated his suicide belt aboard a number 5 bus. 21 people were murdered that day, including Dina's mother and two of her sisters. Dina herself had suffered a serious leg wound and still walked with a slight limp. Next came a pair of men in their 40s, Yossi and Yakov. Tall and balding, Yossi was currently assigned to the Russia desk of research, which is how the office referred to its analytical division. He had read classics at All Souls College at Oxford and spoke with a pronounced English accent. Yakov, a compact man with black hair and a pockmarked face, looked as if he couldn't be bothered with books and learning. For many years he had served in the Arab Affairs Department of Shin Bet, Israel's internal security service, recruiting spies and informants in the West Bank and Gaza. Like Ramona, he had recently transferred to the office and was currently running agents into Lebanon. Next came an oddly mismatched pair who shared one common attribute. Both spoke fluent Russian. The first was Elie Levon, an elfin figure with wispy gray hair and intelligent brown eyes. Levon was regarded as the finest street surveillance artist the office had ever produced. He had worked side by side with Gabriel through countless operations and was the closest thing Gabriel had to a brother. Like Gabriel, Levon's ties to the office were somewhat tenuous. A professor of biblical archaeology at Jerusalem's Hebrew University, he could usually be found waist-deep in an excavation trench, sifting through the dust and artifacts of Israel's ancient past. Twice each year, he lectured on surveillance techniques at the academy, and he was forever being drawn out of retirement by Gabriel, who was never truly comfortable in the field without the legendary Elie Levon watching his back. The figure standing at Levon's side had eyes the color of glacial ice and a fine-boned, bloodless face. Born in Moscow to a pair of dissident Jewish scientists, Mikhail Abramov had come to Israel as a teenager within weeks of the Soviet Union's collapse. Once described by Shamron as Gabriel without a conscience, he had joined the office after serving in the Sayeret Matkal Special Forces, where he had assassinated several of the top terrorist masterminds of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad. His talents were not limited to the gun. The previous summer in Saint-Tropez, he had infiltrated Ivan Kharkov's entourage, along with a CIA officer named Sarah Bancroft. Of all those gathered at the villa by the lake, only Mikhail had the distinct displeasure of actually sharing a meal with Ivan. Afterward, he admitted it was the most terrifying experience of his professional life, this coming from a man who had hunted terrorists across the badlands of the occupied territories. Within the corridors and conference rooms of King Saul Boulevard, these six men and women were known by the codename Barak, the Hebrew word for lightning, because of their ability to gather and strike quickly. They had operated together, often under conditions of unbearable stress, on secret battlefields stretching from Moscow to Marseille, to the exclusive Caribbean island of Saint Barthélemy. Usually they conducted themselves in a highly professional manner, and with few intrusions of egotism or pettiness. Occasionally, a seemingly trivial issue, such as assigning bedrooms, could provoke outbursts of childishness and flashes of ill temper. Unable to resolve the dispute themselves, they turned to Gabriel, the wise ruler, who imposed a settlement by decree and somehow managed to satisfy no one, which in the end they regarded as just. After establishing a secure communications link with King Saul Boulevard, they convened for a working dinner. They ate like a family reunited, which in many respects they were, though their conversation was more circumspect than usual, owing to the presence of an outsider. Gabriel could tell by the inquisitive looks on their faces that they had heard rumors in Tel Aviv, rumors that Amos was yesterday's man, rumors that Gabriel would soon be taking his rightful place in the director's suite at King Saul Boulevard. Only Ramona, Shamron's niece by marriage, dared to ask whether it was true. She did so in a whisper, and in Hebrew, so that Olga could not understand. When Gabriel pretended not to hear, she gave him a covert kick in the ankle, a retaliatory strike only a relative of Shamron would dare undertake. They adjourned to the great room after dinner, and there, standing before a crackling fire, Gabriel conducted the first formal briefing of the operation. Grigory Bolgonov, the Russian defector who had twice saved Gabriel's life, had been abducted by Ivan Karkov and brought to Russia, where in all likelihood he was undergoing a severe interrogation that would end with his execution. They were going to get him back, Gabriel said, and they were going to put Ivan's operatives out of business, and their quest would begin with an extraction and interrogation of their own. In another country, in another intelligence service, such a proposal might have been greeted with expressions of incredulity or even mockery, but not the office. The office had a word for such unconventional thinking, Meshuggah, Hebrew for crazy or foolish. Inside the office, no idea was too meshuggah. Sometimes, the more meshuggah, the better. It was a state of mind. It was what made the office great. There was something else that set them apart from other services, the freedom felt by lower-ranking officers to make suggestions and even to challenge the assumptions of their superiors. Gabriel took no offense when his team embarked on a rigorous deconstruction of the plan. Though they were an eclectic mix, indeed, most were never meant to be field agents at all, they had carried out some of the most daring and dangerous operations in office history. They had killed and kidnapped, committed acts of fraud, theft, and forgery. They were Gabriel's second eyes, Gabriel's safety net. The discussion lasted another hour. Most of it was conducted in English for Olga's benefit, but occasionally they lapsed into Hebrew for reasons of security, or because no other language would do. There were occasional flashes of temper or the odd insult, but for the most part the tone remained civil. When the last issue had been resolved, Gabriel brought the session to a close and broke the team into working groups. Yakov and Yossi would acquire the vehicles and secure the routes. Dina, Ramona, and Chiara would prepare the cover organization and create all necessary websites, brochures, and invitations. The Russian speakers, Mikhail and Eli Levon, would handle the interrogation itself, with Olga serving as their consultant. Gabriel had no specific task other than to supervise and to worry. It was fitting, he thought, for it was a role Shamron had played many times before. At midnight, when the table had been cleared and the dishes washed, they filed upstairs to their rooms for a few hours of sleep. Gabriel and Chiara, alone in the master suite, made quiet love. Afterward, they lay next to each other in the darkness, Gabriel staring at the ceiling, Chiara tracing her fingertip along his cheek.
"Where are you?"
she asked. "Moscow," he said.
"What are you doing?"
"Watching Irina."
"What do you see?"
"I'm not quite sure yet." Chiara was silent for a moment.
You're never happier than when they're around, Gabriel. Maybe Uzi was right. Maybe the office is the only family you have.
You're my family, Chiara.
Are you sure you want to leave them?
I'm sure.
I hear Shimron has other plans.
He usually does.
When are you going to tell him that you're not going to take the job?
As soon as I get Grigori back from the Russians.
Promise me one thing, Gabriel. Promise me you won't get too close to Ivan.
She kissed his lips.
Ivan likes to break pretty things.
Chapter 24. Bellagio, Italy. The Northern Italian Travel Association, or NITA, occupied a suite of small offices on a narrow pedestrian lane in the town of Bellagio, or so it claimed. Its stated mission was to encourage tourism in northern Italy by aggressively promoting the region's incomparable beauty and lifestyle, especially to booking agents and travel writers in other countries. A website for the association appeared soon after Gabriel's team convened on the opposite side of the lake at Villa Teresa. So too did a handsome brochure, printed not in Italy, but in Tel Aviv, along with an invitation to the third annual winter seminar and showcase at the Grand Hotel Villa Serbelloni. Odd, since no one at the Serbelloni would have recalled a first annual showcase and seminar, or even a second for that matter. With only 72 hours until the start of the conference, the organizers were dismayed to learn of a last-minute cancellation and began searching for a replacement. The name Irina Bogdanova of Galaxy Travel, Tsarskaya Street, Moscow, came quickly to mind. Were NITA an ordinary travel association, there might have been some question as to whether Ms. Bogdanova would be able to come to Italy on such short notice. NITA, however, possessed means and methods unavailable to even the most sophisticated organizations. They hacked into her computer and inspected her appointment calendar. They read her email and listened to her telephone calls. Their colleagues in Moscow followed Ms. Bogdanova wherever she went, and even had a peek at her passport to make certain it was in order. Their inquiries revealed much about the tangled state of her personal affairs. They learned, for example, that Ms. Bogdanova had recently stopped seeing her lover for the vaguest of reasons. They learned she was having trouble sleeping at night and preferred music to television. They learned she had recently placed a telephone call to FSB headquarters requesting information as to the whereabouts of her former husband, a question greeted by a curt dismissal. All things considered, they believed a woman in Ms. Bogdanova's position might relish the opportunity to make an all-expenses-paid visit to Italy. And what Muscovite wouldn't? On the day the invitation was sent, the weather forecast was calling for heavy snow and temperatures of perhaps 20 below. It was dispatched via email and signed by none other than Veronica Ricci, NITA's chief executive officer. It began with an apology for the last-minute nature of the offer and concluded with promises of first-class air travel, luxury hotel accommodations, and gourmet Italian cuisine. If Ms. Bogdanova chose to attend, and it was NITA's fervent hope that she would, an information packet, airline tickets, and a welcoming gift would follow. The email neglected to say that the aforementioned materials were already in Moscow and would be delivered by a courier company that did not exist. Nor did it mention the fact that Ms. Bogdanova would remain under surveillance to make certain she was not being followed by agents of Ivan Karkov. It made only one request, that she RSVP as quickly as possible, so that other arrangements could be made should she be unable to attend. Fortunately, such a contingency would not prove necessary, for exactly 7 hours and 12 minutes after the email was sent, a reply arrived from Moscow. At Villa Teresa, the celebration was boisterous but brief. Irina Bogdanova was coming to Italy, and they had much work to do. In every operation, Shamron was fond of saying, there is a choke point. Navigate it successfully, and the operation can sail easily into open waters, stray off course, even by a few degrees, and it can become stranded on the shoals, or worse still, smashed to pieces on the rocks. For this operation, the choke point was none other than Irina herself. As of that moment, they still did not know whether she was heaven sent, or whether she might bring the devil to their doorstep. Handle her well, and the operation might go down as one of the team's finest. Make one mistake, and there was a chance she might get them all killed. They rehearsed as if their lives depended on it. Mikhail's Russian was superior to Eli Levon's, and so it was Mikhail, despite his youth, who would serve as lead inquisitor. Levon,
blessed with a kindly face and unthreatening demeanor, would play the role of benefactor and sage. The only variable, of course, was Irina herself. Olga helped them to prepare for any contingency. At Gabriel's direction, she was terrified one minute, belligerent the next. She cursed them like dogs, collapsed in tears, took a vow of silence, and once flew at them in a blind rage. By the final night, Mikhail and Levon were confident they were prepared for whatever version of Irina they might encounter. All they needed now was the star of the show. But was she Ivan's pawn, or Ivan's victim? It was the question that had troubled them from the beginning, and it was foremost in their thoughts throughout the last long night of waiting. Gabriel made it clear he believed in Irina, but Gabriel was the first to admit his faith had to be viewed through the prism of his well-known fondness for Russian women. The women, he said over and over, were Russia's only hope. Other members of the team, Yakov in particular, took a far less optimistic view of what lay ahead. Yakov had seen mankind at its worst, and feared they were about to admit one of Ivan's agents into their midst. The fact she was still alive, he argued, was proof of her perfidy.
If Irina was good, Ivan would have killed her, he said. That's what Ivan does.
With the help of their assets in Moscow and Kingsall Boulevard, they kept careful watch over Irina's final preparations, searching for evidence of treachery. On the evening before her departure, they monitored a pair of telephone calls, one to a childhood friend, the other to her mother. They heard her alarm go off at the ungodly hour of 2:30 a.m., and heard it go off again 10 minutes later while she was in the shower. And at 3:05, they caught a flash of her temper when she called the limousine company to say her car hadn't arrived. Mikhail, who listened to the recording of the call over the secure link, refused to translate it for the rest of the team. Unless Irina was an award-winning actress, he said, her anger was real. As it turned out, the car was only 15 minutes late, something of a coup for late January, and she arrived at Sheremetyevo Airport at 3:45. Shmuel Pled, a field hand from Moscow Station, caught a glimpse of her as she emerged from the car in an angry blur and headed into the terminal. Her plane, Austrian Airlines Flight 606, departed on time and arrived at Vienna Schwechat at 6:47 a.m. local time. Dina, who had flown to the Austrian capital the previous day, was waiting when Irina emerged from the jetway. They walked to the departure gate, separated by a generous gap, and settled into their seats in the third row of the first-class cabin. Irina in 3C along the aisle, Dina in 3A against the window. Upon touching down in Milan, she sent a message to Gabriel. The star had arrived. The show was about to begin. When the aircraft's doors opened, Irina was once more in motion, headed toward passport control at a parade ground clip, her chin at a defiant angle. Like most Russians, she dreaded encounters with men in uniform and presented her travel documents as if braced for combat. After being admitted to Italy without delay, she made her way toward the arrivals hall, where Chiara was holding a sign that read, Nita welcomes Irina Bogdanova, Galaxy Travel. Lior and Motti, Chiara's ever-present bodyguards, were loitering at a nearby information kiosk, eyes fixed on their quarry. No one seemed to take notice of Dina as she headed outside to the passenger pickup area where Gabriel was standing at the door of a rented luxury minibus, dressed in the black suit of a chauffeur and wearing wraparound sunglasses. Two cars back, Yakov was seated behind the wheel of a Lancia sedan, pretending to read the sports pages of Corriere della Sera. Dina climbed into the front passenger seat and watched as Irina boarded the minibus. Gabriel, after quickly scanning her bags for tracking beacons, loaded them into the luggage hold. The drive was 90 minutes in length. They had rehearsed it several times, and by that morning could have done it in their sleep. From the airport they headed northeast through a series of small towns and villages to the city of Como. Had the Grand Hotel Villa Serbelloni been their true destination, they would have split the inverted Y of the lake and headed straight to Bellagio. Instead, they followed the westernmost shoreline to Tromezzo and stopped at a private dock. A boat waited, Lior at the wheel, Murti at the stern. It bore Chiara and Irina slowly across the flat waters of the inlet to the large, tawny orange villa standing at the end of its own peninsula. In the grand entrance foyer was a man with eyes the color of glacial ice and a fine-boned, bloodless face.
Welcome to Italy, he said to Irina in perfect Russian. May I see your passport, please?
Chapter 25. Lake Como, Italy. There is an audio recording of what transpired next. It is 1 minute and 12 seconds in length and resides to this day in the archives of King Saul Boulevard, where it is considered required listening for its lessons in tradecraft and in no small measure for its pure entertainment value. Gabriel had warned them about Arena's temper, but nothing could have prepared them for the ferocity of her response. Ellie Levon, the biblical archaeologist, would later describe it as one of the epic battles in the history of the Jewish people. Gabriel was not present for it. At that moment, he was coming across the inlet by boat and listening to the proceedings over a miniature earpiece. Hearing a sound he took to be the shattering of a crystal vase, he hurried into the villa and poked his head into the dining room. By then, the skirmish was over, and a temporary cessation of hostilities had been declared. Irina was seated along one side of the rectangular table, breathing heavily from exertion, with Yaakov and Ramona each holding one arm. Yossi was standing to one side, with his shirt torn and 4 parallel scratch marks along the back of one hand. Dina stood next to him, her left cheek aflame as if it had been recently slapped, which it had. Mikhail was positioned directly across from Irina, his face expressionless. Levon was at his side, a better angle, staring down at his tiny hands as though he had found the whole sorry spectacle deeply embarrassing. Gabriel slipped quietly into the library, where Olga Sukova, former crusading journalist, now a member in good standing of the team, was seated before a video monitor, headphones over her ears. Gabriel sat next to her and slipped on a second pair of headphones, then looked at the video screen. Mikhail was now slowly turning through the pages of Irina's passport with a bureaucratic insolence. He placed the passport on the table and stared at Irina for a moment before finally speaking again in Russian. Gabriel uncovered one ear and listened to Olga's translation as the interrogation commenced.
You are Irina Yosifovna Bogunova, born in Moscow in December 1965.
That is correct.
Irina Yosifovna Bogunova, former wife of defector Grigory Mikhailovich Bogunov of the Russian Federal Security Service.
That is correct.
Irina Yosifovna Bogunova, traitor and spy for enemies of the Russian Federation.
I don't know what you are talking about.
I believe you do. I believe you know exactly what I am talking about.
Olga lifted her gaze from the monitor.
Maybe he shouldn't be so rough with her. The poor woman is frightened to death.
Gabriel made no response. Eventually, Mikhail might be able to release the pressure, but not now. They needed answers to a few questions first. Was she Ivan's pawn or Ivan's victim? Had she been sent by heaven, or did they have an agent of the devil in their midst? Chapter 26. Lake Como, Italy.
Who are you?
She asked.
If you wish to call me a name, you may refer to me as Yevgeny.
Who do you work for?
That is not important.
You are Russian?
Again, that is not important. What is important is your passport. As a citizen of the Russian Federation, you are not allowed to enter the United Kingdom without obtaining a visa in advance of your arrival. Please tell me how you were able to enter the country without such a visa in your passport.
I've never been to Britain in my life.
You're lying, Irina Yosifovna.
I'm telling you the truth. You said it yourself. Russians need a visa to visit the United Kingdom. The passport contains no visa. Therefore, it is obvious I have never been there.
But you went to London earlier this month to assist in the abduction of your former husband, Colonel Grigory Nikolaevich Bogunov of the Russian Federal Security Service.
That is completely ridiculous.
You were in contact with your former husband after his defection to the United Kingdom.
She hesitated, then answered truthfully.
I was.
You were discussing the possibility of rekindling your romance. Of reuniting. Of remarrying, perhaps.
This is none of your business.
Everything is my business. Now answer my question. Grigory wanted you to come to London.
I never agreed to anything.
But you talked about it.
I listened only.
Your husband is a defector, Irina Yosifovna. Having contact with him is an act of state treason.
Grigory contacted me. I did nothing wrong.
She was resisting. Gabriel had prepared for this scenario. Gabriel had prepared for everything. Give her a crack of the whip, he thought. Let her know you mean business. Mikhail placed 3 sheets of paper on the table. Where were you on January 10th and 11th?
I was in Moscow.
Let me ask you one more time. Think carefully before you answer. Where were you on January 10th and 11th?
Irina was silent. Mikhail pointed to the first sheet of paper.
Your computer calendar contains no entries on any of those dates. No meetings, no lunches, no scheduled phone calls with clients, nothing at all.
January is always slow. This year with the recession...
Mikhail cut her off with a curt wave of his hand and tapped on the second sheet of paper.
Your telephone records show you received more than 3 dozen calls on your mobile, but placed none of your own.
Greeted by silence, he placed his finger on the third sheet of paper.
Your email account shows a similar pattern. Many emails received, none sent. Can you explain this?
No.
Mikhail extracted a manila folder from the attaché case at his feet. Lifting the cover with funereal solemnity, he removed a single photograph. Colonel Grigory Bogalov, climbing into a Mercedes sedan on London's Harrow Road on the evening of January the 10th at 6:12 p.m. He held it carefully by the edges, as though it were crucial evidence in need of preservation, and turned it so Irina could see. She managed to maintain a stoic silence, but her expression had changed. Gabriel, gazing at her face in the monitor, saw it was fear. A remembered fear, he thought, like the fear of a childhood trauma. One more push and they would have her. On cue, Mikhail produced a second photograph, an enlargement of the first. It was grainy and heavily shadowed, but left no doubt as to the identity of the woman seated nearest the car window.
This makes you an accessory to a very serious crime committed on British soil.
Irina's eyes flickered round the room, as if searching for a way out. Mikhail calmly returned both photos to the attaché case.
Let us begin again, shall we? And this time you will answer my questions truthfully. You have no entrance visa for the United Kingdom, valid or otherwise, in your passport. How were you able to enter the country?
Her response was so soft as to be nearly inaudible. Indeed, Mikhail and Levon were not at all sure of what they had just been told. There was no uncertainty, however, at the listening post in the library, which was receiving a crystal-clear signal from a pair of ultra-sensitive microphones concealed inches from Marina's place at the table. Olga looked at Gabriel and said,
"We've got her."
Mikhail looked at Irina and asked her to speak up.
"I used a different passport,"
she said louder this time.
"By that you mean it was in another name?"
"Correct."
"Who gave you this passport?"
"They said they were friends of Grigory. They said I had to use a false passport for my own protection."
"Why didn't you tell me this the first time?"
"They told me that I was never to discuss the matter with anyone. They told me they would kill me."
A single tear spilled onto her cheek. She punched away the tear as if ashamed by her weakness.
"They threatened to kill my entire family. They are not human, these people. They're animals. Please, you have to believe me."
It was not Mikhail who responded, but the previously silent figure seated to his left, the kindly little soul with flyaway hair and a crumpled suit, the better angel who was now holding a letter in his tiny hands, the letter left by Grigory Bogonov in Oxford 2 weeks before his disappearance. He presented the letter to Irina now, as if handing a folded flag to the wife of a fallen soldier. Her hands trembled as she read it.
"I am afraid my desire to reunite with my former wife may have placed her in danger. If your officers in Moscow would check in on her from time to time, I would be grateful."
"We don't think he's dead," Levon said. "Not yet. But we have to work quickly if we're going to get him back."
"Who are you?"
"We're friends, Irina. You can trust us."
"What do you want from me?"
"Tell us how they did it. Tell us how they took your husband, and whatever you do, don't leave anything out. You'd be surprised, Irina, but sometimes the smallest details are the most important."
Chapter 27 Lake Como, Italy. She requested tea and permission to smoke. Yossi and Dina saw to the tea. Levon, a heavy smoker himself, joined her in a cigarette.
her bond cemented by shared tobacco. She turned her body a few degrees and raised a hand to the side of her face like a blinder, thus excluding Mikhail from her field of vision. As far as Irina was concerned, Mikhail no longer existed, and therefore Mikhail did not need to know that the man who deceived her into taking part in the abduction of her husband made first contact on December the 19th. She could recall the date with certainty, because it was her birthday. A birthday she shared with Leonid Brezhnev, which in her childhood was a great honor in school. It was a Monday, she recalled, and her colleagues had insisted on taking her out for champagne and sushi at the O2 lounge at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Given the state of the Russian economy, she had thought it rather a profligate thing to do, but they all needed an excuse to get drunk, and her birthday seemed as good a reason as any. Drunkenness was achieved by 8 o'clock, and they sailed on together until 10, at which point they stumbled into Tverskaya Street and went in search of their cars, though none of them, including Irina Yosifovna Volganova, former wife of the defector Grigory Nikolaevich Boganov, was in any condition to drive. She had left her car a few blocks away in a narrow street where the Moscow City Militia, for a reasonable bribe, of course, allowed Muscovites to park all day without fear of a ticket. The militiaman on duty was a pimply child of 20, who looked as though he was frozen solid from the cold. Still feeling the effects of the alcohol, Irina had tried to give him a generous handful of rubles, but the boy stepped away and made a vast show of refusing to accept the money. At first, Irina found the display rather amusing. Then she saw a man standing by her car. She knew the type instantly. He was a member of the Siloviki, the brotherhood of former or current officers of the Russian security services. Irina knew this because she had been married to such a man for 12 years. They had been the worst years of her life. Irina considered walking away, but knew she was in no shape to take evasive action. And even if she weren't drunk, there was no way she could hide for long. Not in Russia. So she walked over, and with more courage than she was actually feeling at the time, demanded to know what was so damn interesting about her car. The man bade her a pleasant evening, Russian style, first name and patronymic, and apologized for the unorthodox circumstances of their meeting. He said he had an important message concerning her husband.
"Former husband,"
Irina replied. "Former husband," he repeated, correcting himself. And by the way, she could call him Anatoly.
"I don't suppose he showed you any identification,"
Levon wondered in the meekest tone he could manage.
"Of course not."
"Would you please describe him?"
"Tall, well-built, sturdy jaw, blonde hair going to gray."
"Age?"
"Over 50.
"Facial hair?"
"No."
"Eyeglasses?"
"Not then, later though."
Levon let it go, for now.
"What happened next?"
"He offered to take me to dinner. I told him I didn't make a habit of having dinner with strangers. He said he wasn't a stranger, he was a friend of Grigori's from London. He knew it was my birthday. He said he had a present for me."
"And you believed him because you'd had contact with Grigori?"
"That's correct."
"So you went with him?"
"Yes."
"How did you travel?"
"In my car."
"Who drove?"
"He did."
"Where did you go?"
"Cafe Pushkin. Do you know Cafe Pushkin?"
Levon, with an almost imperceptible nod of his head, indicated that he did indeed know the famous Cafe Pushkin. Despite the financial crisis, it was still nearly impossible to get a reservation. But the man named Anatoly had somehow managed to secure a prize table for two in a secluded corner of the second floor. He ordered champagne, which was the last thing she needed, and made a toast. Then he gave her a jewelry box. Inside was a gold bracelet and a note. He said they were both from Grigori.
Did the gift box have a name on it?
"Bulgari." "The bracelet must have cost a fortune."
"And the note. Was it Grigori's handwriting?"
"It certainly looked like his."
"What did it say?"
"It said he never wanted to spend another birthday apart. He said he wanted me to come to London with a man named Anatoly. He said not to worry about money. Everything would be arranged and paid for by Viktor."
"No last name?"
"No."
"But you knew it was Viktor Orlov?"
"I'd read about Grigori and Viktor on the internet. I even saw a photo of the two of them together."
"Then Anatoly described his relationship to Mr. Orlov?"
Did Liddy work for him in a security capacity?
Those were his exact words.
Yes.
And the letter? I take it you were moved by it.
Irina gave an embarrassed nod.
It all seemed real.
Of course it had, thought Gabriel, gazing at Irina in the monitor. But it seemed real because Anatoly, like Gabriel, was a professional, well-versed in the arts of manipulation and seduction. And so it came as no surprise to Gabriel when Irina said she and Anatoly had spent the rest of the evening in pleasant conversation. They had talked about many things, she said, moving from topic to topic with the ease of old friends. Anatoly had seemed to know a great deal about Irina's marriage, things he couldn't possibly have known unless Grigori had told him, or so Irina believed at the time. Over dessert, almost as an afterthought, he had mentioned that the British government was prepared to grant her asylum if she came to London. Money, he had said, would not be a problem. Victor would take care of the money. Victor would take care of everything.
And you agreed to go? Asked Levon.
I agreed to pay a brief visit, but nothing more.
And then?
We talked about the travel arrangements. He said, because of Grigori's circumstances, great care would have to be taken. Otherwise, it was possible the Russian authorities wouldn't allow me to leave the country. He told me not to speak to anyone, but he would be in contact when it was time to go. Then he drove me home. He didn't bother asking my address. He already knew it.
Did you tell anyone?
Not a soul.
When did he make contact with you again?
The 9th of January, as I was leaving my office. A man came alongside me on Tverskaya Street and told me to look in my bedroom closet when I got home. There were suitcases and a handbag. The suitcases were neatly packed with clothing, all my size. The handbag had the usual assortment of things, but also a Russian passport, airline tickets to London, and a wallet filled with credit cards and cash. There was also a set of instructions which I was to burn after reading.
You were to depart the next day?
Correct.
Tell me about the passport.
The photograph was mine, but the name was false.
What was it?
Natalia Primakova.
Lovely, said Levon.
Yes,
she said.
I rather liked it.
Chapter 28. Lake Como, Italy. She did not sleep that night. She did not even try. She was too nervous, too excited, and yes, maybe a bit too frightened. She paced the rooms of the little apartment she had once shared with Grigori, pondered the most trivial of keepsakes as if she might never see them again. In violation of Anatoly's strict instructions, she telephoned her mother, a family tradition before a trip of any magnitude, and she slipped a few personal items into the suitcases of Natalia Primakova. A bundle of yellowed letters, a locket with her grandmother's photo, a small gold cross her mother had given her after the fall of communism. Lastly, her wedding band.
You thought you might be leaving Russia for good.
I allowed myself to consider the possibility.
Do you recall your flight number?
Aeroflot flight 247, departing Sheremetyevo at 2:35 p.m., arriving London Heathrow at 3:40.
Very impressive.
It is what I do for a living.
What time did you leave your apartment?
10 o'clock. Moscow traffic is terrible that time of day, especially on the Leningradsky Prospect.
How did you travel to the airport?
He sent a car.
Was there any trouble with your new passport?
None whatsoever.
Your travel was first class or economy?
First class.
Did you recognize anyone on the flight?
Not a soul.
And when you arrived in London, any problems with the passport there?
None. When the customs officer asked me to state the purpose of my visit, I said tourism. He stamped my passport right away and told me to have a pleasant stay.
And when you came into the arrivals hall?
I saw Anatoly waiting along the railing.
A pause, then.
Actually, he saw me. I didn't recognize him at first.
He was wearing eyeglasses.
And a fedora?
Would you describe his mood, please?
Calm. Very businesslike. He took one of my bags and let me outside the car was waiting.
Do you recall the make?
It was a Mercedes.
The model?
I'm not good with models. It was big, though.
Color?
Black, of course. I assumed it was Victor's. A man like Victor Orlov would only ride in a black car.
What happened next?
He said Grigori was waiting at a safe place. But first, for my protection, we had to make certain no one was following us.
Did he say who he thought might be following you?
No, but it was clear he was referring to Russian intelligence.
Did he talk to you?
He spent most of the time on the telephone.
Did he place calls or receive them?
Both.
Was he speaking English or Russian?
Only Russian, very colloquial.
Did you make any stops?
Just one.
Do you remember where?
It was on a quiet road not far from the airport, next to a pond or a reservoir of some sort. The driver got out of the car and did something to the front and back of the car.
Could he have been changing the license plates?
I couldn't say. It was dark by then. I naturally acted as though nothing was happening.
Do you happen to recall the time?
No, but afterward we headed straight into central London. We were driving along the edge of Hyde Park when the Napoli's telephone rang. He spoke a few words in Russian, then looked at me and smiled. He said it was safe to go see Grigori.
What happened next?
Things moved very quickly. I put on some lipstick and checked my hair. Then I saw something from the corner of my eye, a movement.
She paused.
There was a gun in the Napoli's hand. It was pointed at my heart. He said if I made a sound, he would kill me.
She lapsed into silence, as if unwilling to go on. Then, with a gentle nudge from Levon, she began speaking again.
The car stopped very suddenly, and Natalie opened the door with his other hand. I saw Grigori standing on the sidewalk. I saw my husband.
And Natalie spoke to him. She nodded, blinking away tears. Do you remember what he said?
I will never forget his words. He told Grigori to get in the car, or I was dead. Grigori obeyed, of course. He had no choice.
Levon gave her a moment to compose herself. Did Grigori say anything after he got in?
He said he would do whatever they wanted, that there was no need to harm or threaten me in any way.
Another pause.
I'm not going to tell Grigori to shut his mouth, otherwise he's going to splatter my brains all over the inside of the car.
Did Grigori ever speak to you?
Just once. He told me he was very sorry.
And after that?
He didn't say a word. He barely looked at me.
How long were you together?
Just a few minutes. We drove to a parking garage somewhere close. And they put Grigori into the back of a van with markings on the side. A cleaning service of some sort.
Where did you go?
And then he took me into an adjacent building through an underground passage. And we rode an elevator to the street. A car was waiting nearby. A woman was behind the wheel. And Natalie told me to follow her instructions carefully. He said, if I ever spoke to anyone about this, I would be killed. And then my mother would be killed. And then my two brothers would be killed along with their children.
A heavy silence fell over the dining room of the villa. Irina treated herself to another cigarette. Then, emotionally exhausted, she recounted the remaining details of her ordeal in a detached voice. The long drive to the seacoast town of Harwich. The sleepless night in the Hotel Continental. The stormy crossing to Hoek van Holland aboard the Stena Britannica car ferry. And the trip home aboard Aeroflot Flight 418, operated by KLM Royal Dutch Airlines, departing Amsterdam at 8:40 p.m., arriving Sharm el-Devil at 2 a.m. the following morning. Did you and the woman travel together or separately?
Together.
Did she ever give your name?
No. But I heard the flight attendant call her Miss Gromova.
And when you arrived in Moscow?
A kind driver took me to my apartment. The next morning I returned to work as if nothing had happened.
Was there any other contact?
Nothing.
Did you have the impression you were under surveillance?
If I was, I couldn't see them.
And when you received the invitation to attend a conference in Italy, they made no effort to prevent you from attending? She shook her head. Were you at all reluctant after what you had just been through?
The invitation seemed very real. Just like a Nepalese.
A silence, then.
I don't suppose there really is a conference, is there?
No, there isn't.
Who are you?
She asked again. We truly are friends of your husband. And we're going to do everything we can to get him back for you.
What happens now?
The same as before. You'll return to your job at Galaxy Travel and pretend this never happened.
after you attend the third annual seminar and showcase of the Northern Italian Travel Association, of course. But you just said it wasn't real. Reality is a state of mind, Irina. Reality can be whatever you want it to be.